Good morning to all of those in Woodside worshiping with us and those online. Glad that we can be together. It's cold outside. And when it's cold outside, I look for comfort, don't you? So last night I went to the grocery store and bought food because food equals comfort. And I made a stew last night and put it in a slow cooker, which means when I woke up this morning, I came down to a home that was just, you would have wanted to be in my home this morning. I had stew for breakfast. And I'm going to have stew for lunch. And it has nothing to do with my message. I just wanted you to know stew is really a good choice for today. Don't you agree with that? Well, there we go. Hey, we're continuing this series called Connecting the Dots, looking at church history. For those who are guests, yeah, we're doing a series on church history. It's really interesting, though. You're going to love that you're here today. I think you will. And invite you to take out your teaching notes because it really is helpful when you're going through church history. Just there's so much, you know. We're trying to, in 30 minutes, try to encapsulate some of the things that happened, and we're going to do that today. By the end of last week, we had covered the age of Catholic Christianity from AD 70 to 312. And you should ask the good question, why Catholic, why AD 70, and why 312? Well, Catholic, because the word Catholic literally means universal. All Christians everywhere. It's Catholic with a lowercase c because there was no Roman Catholic Church the way we understand it at this time in history. And because so many of you come from that background, and for many of us who don't come from that background, we wonder, where did Roman Catholicism come from the way we have it today? I just want to say, because I'm not addressing the fullness of that question, that it's like a snowball. Its effect comes over slowly, a long period of time. And by the end of the 6th century, and really 5th century, we're pretty much there for the core of what will become Roman Catholicism. So it doesn't happen for some time to come. AD 70, because Jerusalem fell in AD 70. And as a result of that, the church went out from Jerusalem into the Gentile world. And Gentiles came to Jesus Christ by faith in mass into the church, just as God had purposed it to be. And 312, because 312 came forth from the Roman Empire, the Edict of Toleration, to tolerate Christians. And I could say the paraphrase of the Edict of Toleration was simply stop killing Christians. It became the end to the persecution of the church, which had always been part of its journey. What a chapter of peace that will begin to unfold. Let me go through 5 primary marks of the age of Catholic Christianity that we've talked about just for review, catch us up here a little bit. In the 1st century, we saw the spread of Christianity very fast. By the time we get to the 4th century, what we're talking about today, the church is throughout the whole Roman Empire. In the 1st century, we also looked at the persecution of Christians and how in the midst of even that persecution, the church grew very fast. In that period of time, there were 10 Roman emperors who were killing Christians forthrightly, others who complemented it in various ways. We've been kind of playing with Facebook. If you had Facebook in the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th century, what it would look like. And this is what it would look like. You'd get these shady figures with names like these showing up on your Facebook. And I just say to you, don't friend them. If you get these emperors, they killed people. These guys, look at that, Severus. I mean, just the name. You stayed away from these guys. Don't friend them. In the 3rd century, or 2nd century, we had the formulation of the creeds. We talked about how important the creeds are. If you come out of a high church, Anglican, Catholic, high church, Lutheran background, you still have liturgical creeds read as part of every service. It goes all the way back to this time. It's a good thing because Docetism and Gnosticism, all these heresies were popping up, and the creeds gave us a focus, a place to understand what we believed about Jesus Christ. In the 2nd century, we also saw the rise of the bishop, and it was an important move because we talked about the church being first organized by the Apostle Paul, going from village to town, and how churches were born, how they were organized, and they generally had bishops, elders, and deacons. And it was autonomous. It was the autonomy of the local church. They had their way of doing worship, writing their own songs, but the bishop and these deacons worked in their own local parishes. Westwood is still organized as a church around that model. We don't call them by the same name, but rather than bishops, it's pastor, but bishops were pastors in that day. Rather than elders, we have a leadership board who oversee the direction of the church. And rather than deacons, we call them ministry team leaders, the people who serve the purposes of God here every day. It's what makes this place so vital. It's all of those people who are teaching your kids downstairs right now and in the parking lot, serving and helping the way they do. And that's how the church was organized. But in the 2nd century, the role of the bishop rises. Hierarchy begins to take place. And can I just say there was good reason for it? All of the heresies threatened. It created confusion in local churches. And so the rise of the bishop gave an authoritative voice to bring us together in greater spirit of unity in the midst of the heresies. And in the beginning, the intentions were really good. It will come to be a problem later on. And then last week we looked at the third century and how the New Testament was codified, and I'm not going to be able to get into that, but if you want to know how the New Testament came together and how we know it's authoritative for life, faith, and practice, download last week's message. They're free, and you get that grounding because it's really important because the scriptures become our compass for life. So from 70 to 312, you have this time when there is no schism in Christianity. There's no doctrinal splits. We come close to it because of the heresies, but we're held together through that period of time. There's no geographical splits because they've stayed together under one unity. That split of the kingdom will happen in today's message a little bit. So you could say it was a honeymoon period, even though Christians were dying left and right. But we were together in our devotion to Jesus Christ. Now we turn the page to a new era, the rise of the imperial Christianity from 312 to 590. In this window of time, I want you to hold on to this, the head of the church was the Roman emperor. Did you catch that? You should be flinching in your seats right now. The Roman emperor became the head of church, not the bishops, you know, not the patriarchs, but the head of the Roman Empire. The very emperors who were killing Christians now become the head of the church. What a fascinating thing. And the church and the state are now united into one man or under one man's voice. And the question gets raised, how do you go from killing Christians to become head of the church? Isn't that a good question? How does that happen? It did not happen overnight. It was a thunderclap. It happened overnight. It wasn't a process. It just happened instantaneously, practically. In fact, when you look at the history, it involved because of one man and one battle and one miraculous vision. And we're going to look at three movements of this time period, beginning with movement number one, Constantine himself, and the emergence of the Christian emperor. Got an updated Facebook posting for you of Constantine. I love those eyes. I send these outlines to our production team by midweek, and then they send stuff back to me, and I get this kind of stuff. His selfie needs work, but here's the newest member of the church, Emperor Constantine. So I said, oh, keep it on there. It's good. He may be one of the 10 most important people who've walked the face of the earth, Constantine. Big deal. And you have to ask the question I did when I was studying this week is, will we see him in heaven? And I don't know if we do. All the scholars that I read think that his conversion was sincere, and I don't question that something happened there. He did such great things in the name of God, but he also did such horrific things as an emperor to the Roman Empire, and those values conflict for me. Let me back up a little bit before Constantine. As I said, Christianity was growing so fast. But with the rise of Christianity, the devotion to the pagan Greco and Roman gods was dwindling. And it became almost competitive. And in a last desperate struggle to keep worship to the pagan gods alive, the Emperor Diocletian, along with a good buddy of his, Galerius, authored a statement of focus of persecution to Christians. And let me tell you, it was similar to what you have with ISIS today. In fact, when you hear about ISIS and what they're doing, they do not reflect modern Islamic conviction. They're taking their practices all the way back from the 7th century. And they learned it all the way back to the 4th century. And so crucifixions and beheadings were the common way that you killed your enemy in that time and place. And Diocletian decided to just ramp it up against Christians, and it got ugly. It was a slaughter, Christians everywhere that were martyred for their faith. Diocletian is one of the few emperors to actually retire and move to a lake cabin somewhere, put his feet up at the end of his life. Most of them were killed along the way, but he retires, and Galerius becomes the emperor from 305 to 311, and he wants to put an end to the slaughter that he and Diocletian actually had begun. And he doesn't do it because of compassion. He does it through the Edict of Toleration, to tolerate Christians, because what was happening is so many Christians were martyred, and they were martyred so horrifically that they became heroes in their communities. And when they became heroes, what happened? Christianity grew more. more came to be part of it. So he says, let's get rid of this with the edict of toleration and let them coexist in the Roman Empire, because then Christianity may die if we stop killing folks. Before, they thought if you kill them, people won't believe. But in fact, it grew. They said, now don't kill them and then Christianity will die. Of course, it does not die. Well, after Galerius dies, it was a jump ball, if I can use a basketball metaphor, that went up to see who would be the next Roman emperor. In fact, you might think that the succession of the emperors just came from children, and sometimes that was the case. But by this time in the Roman Empire, it was falling apart. And so the kingdom was divided, with generals having territories, and the generals were like mafia fighting for power and authority. And we have two main players here, General Maxentius and then General Constantine, who met with their armies just outside of Rome at the Melvian Bridge. And the mindset was winner take all. Whoever wins goes to the throne. And you'd have to put your money on Max, because he had a massive army as compared to the little team that Constantine had. But before the battle, Constantine had a vision. And this painting is one of the most well-known paintings in all of history. It's a picture of the vision that Constantine had. It was a vision of the cross in a sun behind it, and a voice saying to him, conquer by this sign. And he believed the Christian God, Jesus Christ, said, I am going to give you victory. And so he instructed all of his soldiers to paint the cross on their shields and to enter into that battle. And despite their small army, the soldiers of the cross triumphed. The great historian Eusebius, who was a contemporary of Constantine and a friend of his, wrote these words. He said, the pious emperor, glorying in the cross of victory, preached the Son, S-O-N, of God to the Romans with great boldness. And the whole city, reviving from the burden of bitter tyrannical oppressions, seemed to be born again into fresh new life. Friends, the unthinkable happened. A Roman emperor becomes a Christian. These very emperors who had been causing the persecution, now, as Constantine states, comes to faith in Jesus Christ. His wife becomes a Christian. He raises his children in the Christian faith. His rule, however, doesn't always reflect the fruit of the Spirit, as we say. So it creates some confusion along the way. He didn't live his life fully devoted to the ways of Christ. And he got this severe illness. He didn't reign all that long, actually. And he got this severe illness, and he made the pledge. He said, I'll be baptized, and with the hope that I would recover from this illness. And if I recover from this illness, quote unquote, he said, I promise to live a more Christian life. Well, how many on their deathbed say, God, help me, help me, help me. Give me another chance and I'll live a more Christian life. Unless we throw stones at a guy like Constantine. I think about us. Think about you and your own salvation. Have you grown into holiness right away? There's a journey, isn't there? There's the fullness of Christ that still comes to us. We die to old sins along the way. Now, his were massively big, to say the least. But he comes to this place, and he is baptized, and shortly thereafter, he dies. He doesn't get the extended window for life, and he dies. But, and this is where I think we will see him in heaven, he says, rather than being buried in the traditional royal robe of the emperor, he wanted to be buried in the humble white garment of baptism of his wife. Unheard of. It reflects a spirit of humility. The thief of the cross, you know, Jesus said, today you will be with me in paradise. It could have been well for Constantine the same way, but I hope that's the case, because I want to ask him about that vision at a rock by some stream in heaven. Do you ever have dream of things like that? You need some stew, don't you? Okay, let me keep going. Let me give you the good, the bad, and the ugly of this guy. The good is amazing. You're going to like him by the time I'm telling you some of the good. There was religious freedom for all, even beyond the Christians. Everyone got religious freedom in the Roman Empire. Now, friends, can I say something to you? Let us not ever take for granted the freedom of religion that we enjoy. Because even today, there are many countries where you don't have that freedom to leave that cold parking lot, to walk into the warmth of this place, to worship freely Jesus Christ. And even though we be the land that has the freedom of speech, and we're entitled to these things, right? We find a lot of pride. Let us not be arrogant about our rights. Let us, with humble gratitude, give thanks for the religious freedom we enjoy every day. Amen? That's a good thing for us. And Constantine helped us move into a greater appreciation of it. And then secondly, there's compensation for the persecuted. These Christians who lost loved ones, who were martyred, many had their properties taken from them, their goods taken from them, their livelihood taken from them. And the Roman Empire says that's wrong. And so they compensated all of those losses. You can't bring dead back to life, but they brought back their estates and their farms and their goods to the best of their ability and then gave them money if they didn't have those possessions available. That's a pretty good thing for a guy to do, right? So you're already liking him a little bit more. You're going to love him with this next one. At least I love him with this next one. Clergy privileges, pay, and benefits. He even gave ministers a tax exemption. Hallelujah. What a guy. You know, we need more leaders like this. This is my feeling. See, we see everything through our own personal filter, right? Well, they had the same clergy privileges as did the pagan priests of the day. Access to judges and all the resources of the kingdom. Amazing change. And then he did this. I mean, this guy is good. New buildings and new Bibles. Instead of burning the Bibles, which had become their practice, now they were printing more Bibles or creating more Bibles to be distributed throughout the kingdom, the Roman Empire. What a deal that was. And then you see something that is, it's a phenomena, the birth of church architecture. Wouldn't you agree it's one of the most beautiful, compelling art forms that you've ever been exposed to? In fact, one of Christianity's most holy sites is St. Peter's Basilica. And here's the interior of it today. It was constructed in the fourth century. Isn't that something? Now, it's gone through, obviously, a lot of additions, et cetera, and the beauty of it. But you can see the magnificence and the beauty of the wealth of the Roman Empire brought to architectural design now for the first time with church buildings. And then you can even go to the Hagia Sophia in Istanbul, Turkey, which is on the east side of things. And if you look at this building, this is the remains of it, really something. It served as the cathedral to Constantinople from 360, this fourth century, all the way to 1453 when it became a mosque. And was a mosque until 1934 when it became a museum. Carrie and I were there a couple of years ago. We got to go to the sites, a museum you can go to today. As the Ottoman Empire got secularized in present-day Turkey, they turned it into a museum. And you can go to these places. You just see the beauty of the architectural design. And okay, I take this a little bit personally. I go, how did they build buildings like this? I go into some of these church structures, and even in the Twin Cities, I go, what in the world? Because having started a church by God's grace and through the work of a lot of people and the help and strength of Jesus Christ, we were in three locations before we bought the land. It took us forever to find the land, to pay for the land, then to build this building. And how did it get paid through? The sacrifice of you, the people who came. And I look at these buildings, I go, you couldn't build something like that today. How did it get built? Through the wealth of the empire. Not through the offerings of the Christians. It became something in the Roman Empire to give generously to the construction of these beautiful architectural designs. Is this a good or bad thing? Maybe both and, when you start to see what happens along the way. Let me give you another one. He outlawed crucifixion in the gladiatorial games. Isn't that something? The influence of Christianity would bring an end to those things through the influence of the Roman Empire. The abuse of slaves, their treatment was much better under his reign. The killing of unwanted children, which was the norm of the day, ended. And he decreed that all prisoners should see the sun every day. Aren't you liking this guy? He did a lot of good things. And he did something that most of you are enjoying right now and you don't even know it. And that is, he made Sunday a day of rest. Constantine gave you this day. Everybody, pay attention. Say thank you to Constantine, would you? That was so pathetic. Say thank you to Constantine. Wow. 820 was better than that. I'm telling you, this guy gave us a day off, not for worship, but for a day of rest. Isn't that something that comes out of the Roman Empire? Otherwise, you'd be working 7 days a week still, probably. He changed the trajectory of your life. Let's go to the bad side, though. You had one man in authority, and as it is said, absolute power corrupts absolutely. One man over the whole empire, too much empire for one man to deal with. And you compromise. And you become corrupt without even wanting to, just by nature of the job. He ruled with brutal force, the same brutal force of pagan emperors. You go, how do you do that if you're a Christ follower? He arranged for his firstborn son to be killed, who was in succession to the throne. Now, how does a Christ follower do that? You can see my conflict here. And then you look at the fusion of Christian faith with old faith. When he made Sunday a day of rest as opposed to a day of worship, he did it for non-Christian reasons. Quote, this is from Constantine. It seems to us improper that the day of sun, S-U-N, which is kept for veneration, should be spent in legal disputes. He simply saw Christianity not as negating his old faith, but as complementing it. And the priority god of his old faith was worshiping the deity of the sun god. He kept that in place. By the way, P.S., Christmas arrives in the scene for Christians in the 4th century. So the practice of Christmas was not something that was part of the journey of the Christian church until the 4th century. And it was selected, the date December 25th was selected in the 4th century to celebrate Christmas, but it was chosen December 25th because it's the Roman feast of the birth of the unconquered sun, S-U-N. It was a pagan feast. And the emperor, who worshipped the pagan sun god, chose that day, blending two. So when you hear criticisms that Christmas was founded on a pagan religious practice, it's true. It was. Now, I don't think we approach it that way. We approach it believing that we should celebrate the incarnation and the birth of Jesus Christ. And all children in the room, do you think we should still practice Christmas? Or adults in the room? Because yeah, please. It's important. Well, Constantine put that in motion. And then you found that he forced people to convert to Christianity. How does that strategy work for you? Trying to force a spouse to come to faith, children to come to faith, friends to come to faith. You ever tried to do that? Doesn't work very well. People don't like to be forced to anything. But under the Roman Empire, this was a big change along the way, and it continued. By the time Theodosius follows Constantine after he dies, he makes it illegal in the Roman Empire to be a pagan. So it was illegal to be a Christian all of those first few centuries. Now it's illegal to be a pagan. I mean, how can you connect the dots of what happened in the Roman Empire during this time? And death evangelism became the norm. So you had a sword and you were baptized, and you said you either believe or die. You know, you're either baptized into the church or not. And so you had a lot of people who weren't Christ followers become members of local churches along the way because they were living in fear. So they adopted Christianity. And then a couple of things related to the ugly of what he did. He moved the capital from Rome to Byzantium in Turkey, and he changed the name to Constantinople. I've got a map of it, a simple map to show you. And you got to ask the question, why in the world would he take the capital of the Roman Empire from Rome and bring it over into Turkey, which eventually would become Istanbul, as we know? Why would he do that? Well, if you go to the north and all the European countries and Scandinavian countries, especially the Scandinavians, were making their way south. All those blonde-haired, blue-eyed people were starting to conquer and divide the Roman Empire themselves, and they were going to destroy the capital of Rome. That was the big kahuna, get to Rome, destroy it. So he moves Constantine moves it to Istanbul, and there he establishes what's called Byzantium at the time and establishes the new capital. It's the new capital of the Roman Empire in the east, and it all happens during his reign. So you have Rome in the west, Constantinople in the east, and with 500 years, you will have the east-west split between Christianity, and it was an ugly split, between Roman Catholicism and Eastern Orthodoxy. But Christianity is the official religion of the Roman Empire by now. Amazing what changed from the last century. And then one last ugly thing was the emulation of Roman structure in church governance. See, in church in Rome, you had the emperor who was over the whole empire. Then he had leaders who were over large regions. And then he had other leaders who were over cities. And then he had other leaders who were over local communities and towns. Well, the church adopted that hierarchical ecclesiastical structure. The Roman Empire, a Roman emperor, was over the church of the empire as a whole. But then you had other people who emerged. So you have the bishop who takes large regions and archbishops and patriarchs. And then local towns end up having priests for the first time. And they serve the local parishes. And they reflect what happens in the government of Rome. The ecclesiastical system for the Catholic Church is by now in place. And in due time, that role of the bishop, which has been rising already in hierarchy and control and authority, will go to the point to be the top dog, top guy, and become papa or pope, as you'll see. There's an illustration I came across in reading about these bishops and all that was happening, because the church's new norm was no longer persecution, holiness, or suffering, but it was power, authority, and wealth. Do you think that impacts the life of the church? It does profoundly. And I find this exchange between two different bishops, where one bishop is talking about the gold and the silver and how much it's grown to be part of building designs compared to what they had previously, next to nothing along the way. And the one bishop says, no longer as the blessed Peter do we have to say, silver and gold I have none. To which the other bishop replied back to him, that is true. But neither can we say as Peter, in the name of Jesus, stand up and walk. Do you see what happened? When the church in its early days was alive and well, it had little wealth, much persecution, deep devotion and passion for Jesus Christ and his way. But by now, the church has a lot of wealth and it's passion and love for Jesus Christ diminishes because the motivation is no longer always the purposes of God. It's about securing the wealth. Not a good day for the church. For Westwood, can I just throw this in? Could we be devoted to the purposes of Christ? Could we be a church marked by love and passion for the purposes of Christ and not dissuaded by the things that might tempt us into a world of comfort greater than the call of Christ in our life, where sacrifice and inconvenience is part of the journey of following him? But it's not sacrifice and inconvenience when you're in touch in your heart with the reality of what he did for us on Calvary's cross. It's a privilege to serve his purposes and to give ourselves to that end. Well, then we go into the second movement. Most of my message was on Constantine. Was that okay? Did you hang in there with that? Isn't it interesting to see the then and the now and how it all shapes us? And then we took at these other movements. I'm just going to touch on them briefly. They deserve far more than the time allotment that I have. But you have the second, which is the theological civil wars over the divinity of Jesus and the debate in Nicaea between Arius, the bishop of Egypt, and Athanasius, the bishop of Rome. And the emperor was fed up because now, since Christians aren't being persecuted any longer, they create their own battles. And it's about who is Jesus and who do we believe him to be, because they got time now to do that. So now they're killing each other with words. And the emperor has enough of it himself. He brings them together to Nicaea. 300 different bishops were around the empire and says, go into the room, get it worked out, and don't come out until you're all together on the same page. And so they go duke it out in this Nicaea deal. And the question that divided them was to dominate the church for the whole century and even to the next. Who is Jesus? Because the church worshiped him as God. The New Testament called him God. And yet the scriptures were clear that we are not to worship anyone but one God, and that worshiping anyone else would be blasphemous. So how does it add up? God the Father, Jesus the Son. How are the two one? So what you saw arising was the debate around the Trinity, which would take place well over 100 years. You'll hear more about it next week. Well, Athanasius championed the deity of Jesus Christ, stating that Jesus is the same substance as the Father. And Arius, who said Jesus was not identical to the substance with the Father, but was similar to. And they were very close words in the Greek that they were battling over. And Arius' hang-up was with the idea that Christ was eternal, that if he had no beginning, then you had two uncreated creators. How does that work? And he was a songwriter, too. See, every generation has had its songwriters. In the 1960s, a lot of our songs were in rebellion against the state. And he had songs in rebellion against the church. And I kind of chuckled when I read the lyrics of this particular song, and I'm going to share them with you, when he has this little ditty, this line that says, the essence of the Father is foreign to the Son. The essence of the Father is foreign to the Son. The essence of the Father is foreign to the Son. You can see the power of music. He's trying to get it into the minds of people, probably with a good beat, because we love the beat before we understand the lyrics, right? We sing songs today that are totally pagan songs, and we love the songs. Then we listen to the words, and we go, oh my, I've been singing that song for a long time, never even thinking about it. You ever had that experience? I listened to some of the songs that are my favorite songs in the 60s and 70s, and I go, maybe not so much. This was one of those kind of songs. And so, anyways, he writes the little ditty along the way, and there's this division that happens. By the way, I have to say, we still have a group of people who practice the Arian way today, even though he'll lose in this battle. And you've had them come to your door, Jehovah's Witnesses. Embrace the Arian way and theology. And so this first ecumenical council of Nicaea would secure in our traditions the foundational beliefs that would carry us through every century to the day that we live today. Arius lost big time. He was outcast from the church. And the Athanasian Creed was given to us with 44 statements, all reflecting the unity of the Trinity. The Father uncreated, the Son uncreated, the Holy Spirit uncreated, the Father eternal, the Son eternal, and the Holy Spirit eternal. And yet they are not three eternals, but one eternal. It was written in 325 AD. Funny, we don't do that creed much today, but it shapes how we think of the Trinity for sure. By the way, next time you have a Jehovah's Witness come to your door, invite them in. Sit down. Have a cup of coffee together with them. And as everything relaxes and you sit around the room, I want you to say out loud, I am not an Arian. I hold to the orthodox position of Athanasia, creed of 325 AD. I want you to write that down. Put it on your cupboard because they'll come. And invite them in and just see. You'll have a fun conversation because they'll go, how did you know about that? Because they know where they believe and where it came from. Let's connect the dots of what we believe and where it comes from. And then the third movement is related to monasticism. Oh, I wish I had just a whole message to give you on this, and I've got just a few minutes. And it's the arise of the hermits and monasteries. So instrumental in the Church of Jesus Christ. And you go, why are they called hermits? Well, the Latin word hermit means desert. So with all these mass conversions came new church buildings in every local town and village. Now you have to go to church. So we talk about the difference in your attitude when you have to go to church versus when you get to be the church. There is a difference. We want to be a get to be the kind of church that we are versus we have to go to church, and your energy around that is profoundly different. Well, now everybody has to go to church. Who do you even evangelize? Because everybody is evangelized by the sword. You don't have a choice. They bring their immorality into the church, so they have to worship because there's accountability to that in your community, or you could be, you know, threatened with heresy. So you went to church, and the church compromised its moral integrity. And true Christians in the church had enough of it. So they left, and they moved out into the desert, into caves and in trees, etc. We think of them as being a bit eccentric, and some of them were indeed strange birds along the way. But many of them were just heartfelt, devoted Christians who were just trying to find some sense of order with the way of Christ together with other Christ believers. Whole towns grew up around this. Whole cities became part of the monastic order. And of course, many left thinking that the flesh and the temptation that came with it would be protected in these new cities. But what happens? The temptation of your flesh, friends, will be with you whether you're in the Alexandria or Rome or Constantinople versus a monastic community. You bring that with you wherever you go, and you have to manage it. Yeah, maybe it's easier to manage with accountability of Christ's followers, but let me just say, the bad was monasteries became as corrupt as any other place. The good is they preserved two things, scholasticism. We have more New Testament manuscripts than any other ancient literature because of the monks who would, for months on end, write the scriptures over and over and over. We have so many manuscripts. When we talk about the credibility of the Bible for life, faith, and practice, you see the continuity passed in all of these manuscripts. The monks really are to be attributed great credit for that. And then also the commitment to New Testament piety. They preserved a moral code that comes from the Holy Scriptures in the New Testament. Two guys, just briefly, Jerome, who had left offended by the people in churches in the big cities and went to a monastery in Bethlehem and did something that nobody had done up until that point. He translated the Bible from Greek and Hebrew into the common language, which was Latin, which became the Latin Vulgate, which became the standard Bible for the Roman Catholic Church and became the norm that every people group and nation would have the Bible in its own language. He started that. And then there was Benedict, and you've heard of the Benedictine rules of order, and they're still alive and well today. He was to organization what Jerome was to scholasticism, and he just had a great sense of order and accountability. You made vows to chastity, obedience, and poverty, and they really preserved the integrity of spiritual piety, devotion to Jesus Christ, and we can be grateful for Benedict to that end, as morality was compromised in the local church. And by the way, to make it, because how do you live in these communities, these towns? You still have a question, how do you live? So they created their own businesses. You could just live in these communities, and they kind of export. So they found great grapes and made incredible wine. And the Benedictines to this day have the finest brandy in the world, B&B brandy by the Benedictines. And you're thinking to yourself, Joel, how do you know that? Because I read it. That's how I know it. It was the monks who kept this devotion to Christ alive. Now, we need to wrap up and be done here soon, but we don't have our own Benedict that's part of our church family here, but we do have Benno Rosenbusch, our worship leader. And we have Benna Garrett, who I sent over to Woodside, and I asked Benna Rosenbush, who's been leading at Woodside, to come back here because I want to ask him a couple of questions. Come on over, Ben. In these four centuries, we see that the shape of worship in churches changes. The autonomy of the local church that you see early in the first and second century, the rise of the bishops where now there's more control. So many of you come out of a liturgical background where the worship is the same. You do the same creeds oftentimes. And many of you, how many of you come from that kind of background out of curiosity? And the first time you came to Westwood, you go, whoa, this is not my father's church. I'm not sure that I can be here because you're so used to going in and having this order. That happened in those first centuries when the bishop's role tried to unify churches and they brought the liturgy, homilies from the same text, all of that. We're part of the camp that is more autonomous. So we, each week, we don't take from a liturgical calendar. We come together and we pray over what's happening here and say, how do we want to come into the worship experience? Ben helps put all of that together. So when we do that, what are you trying to do? Just take a couple minutes and inform them, okay?
Well, thanks for asking, Joel.
Yeah, you're welcome.
It's good Benna to be with Rosenbush, you guys, right?
Do you like the new name?
I don't know if that'll stick. We'll see. Yeah.
Benna Rosenbush, okay.
But so there's a couple things that I just wanted to share with you guys today. And the first is when we approach worship, I shared this a bit ago when I shared last year on this topic, that worship moves us in, or sorry, worship moves us up, in, and then out. And this works so well with our open hands vision that we live into as a Westwood community, that when we gather together, our worship lifts up to God. This is in response to the revelation that he's put inside our hearts of who he is. And so with open hands, we lift our praises up to God. When we do this, something happens inside of us. We're changed, we're transformed, we become new people. Our spirit connects with his spirit, and that's what happens. And so with open hands, we receive from him. And when that happens, too, we can't hold it in. So we go from here, we're sent out, inspired to share that. What gets poured into us gets poured out. And so with open hands, we give away. So worship moves us up, in, and out when we approach it with those open hands. Something else I'd like to share, too, is that we love ancient future worship. Robert E. Weber, who's an author, wrote a book by that title and a whole bunch of books under ancient future. And in that, he says that we sing, we tell, and we enact the story of God from beginning to end. And I love that quote. It kind of says that we celebrate what God has done, what he is doing, and what he will do. And so every part of our worship gathering, when we come together, seeks to tell that story, come together and do that, and to invite us into that, to realize that this is our story that we get to live into. And so when you come, you'll experience things that are from the past and things that are from the future, the things that are full of rich history and the things that are newness, have newness and vibrancy of the future. So when you come together, we'll have baptism and creeds along with hymns right next to a song that might have been written last week. So, and I think a good picture for me in thinking about ancient future worship is a tree that... A tree thrives and lives because it has roots and new buds, both of those together. So that's what we hope for ancient future worship. And the last thing, Joel, I'd love to say is that we're in this
okay,
together.
Go ahead.
I'm good.
I want you to hear because it influences everything we do. It's so good. Go ahead.
Well, the last thing is that we're in this together, that music and worship that we're doing is not something that happens to us. This is not a concert. This is something we partake in together. I tell my worship team often that the stage that we sing from, although it's elevated, it's lifted up, it's actually coming underneath the congregation. We seek to be servants. We seek to be people who inspire to that we all would sing as one voice. And in a world that's really polarized, that's disparate, that's disunified, what a gift it is to come together like this, right, and become one voice. That we are many voices, but we become one. We're many bodies, but we're the body of Christ. And this is our symbol of what God does among us, that we're in this together. And so just be invited to open your hands up, which is what we say at Westwood, and to engage in worship. God has something to do in your heart and in my heart. And I'm so glad that we're in this together.
And you're going
to
close us in a song, right?
Let's do it.
Let's give thanks to Ben and his team for good work. But I hope... I hope this gives you understanding to why we have our different, you know, some of you come out of an autonomy of a local church and come saying, well, those aren't the songs I sang in my church. Some of you come out of a liturgical background and go, where did this come from? And I was confirmed in the ALC, American Lutheran Church, which is as close to Catholicism as you can get. I can go to a Catholic church and I can do the liturgy verbatim from beginning to end. It's still that unified. I'm astonished how much I can participate with it. I'm saying there's different ways of doing it. There's good in all of it, but the key is our heart devoted to God, and we're going to celebrate the past. We're going to write new songs for tomorrow and be doing it all. Would you stand? Let's close in song before we go and have our stew.